Alright, so the Gemara in Makos, in the tractate of Makos, and on the 24th folio, right at the end, actually, with this story, that tractate concludes. The Gemara tells a story about four rabbis. One of them was Rabban Gamliel, the other one was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the other one was Rabbi Yeshua, and finally Rabbi Akiva. And they're traveling towards Jerusalem, towards the Temple Mount. And they arrive at Harat Sofim. In Australia, that's known as Mount Scopus.
I went to Hebrew.
What's that?
I went to Hebrew. I know how
that is. But no relation to the school. Or maybe there's a relation. I'm not aware of it. So they come to Harat Sofim. They come to Mount Scopus. And they rend their garments, as is appropriate. When you see the temple destroyed, this was after the temple had been destroyed, the Beit HaMikdash is no longer in existence. So they rend their garments, and they continue traveling, and they arrive at the Har Habayis, they arrive at the Temple Mount. And they see that in the place where the Holy of Holies was, where the Kodesh HaKadoshim was, they see a fox has made its den. A fox comes running out. And as you would expect, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, they all cry. They weep, of course. You see such a sight, such a tragedy. You're overcome, you're overwhelmed with emotion, you weep. And Rabbi Kiva starts smiling or laughing, or he's merry. Different interpretation of exactly what it means. So they ask him, Rabbi Kiva, why are you laughing? And Rabbi Kiva says, why are you crying? I guess he was Jewish, so he answered a question with a question. And they say, the reason that we're crying is obvious. This is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. This is the place where it says that no man is allowed to go into this place, except, of course, the Kohen Gadol, on one day a year, Yom Kippur, because it's too holy, it's so holy. And a fox has made its home there. I mean, how degrading, how embarrassing, how horrific. So that's why we're crying. But Rabbi Akiva, why are you laughing? Why are you happy? And Rabbi Akiva says, for the same reason. Because Rabbi Kiva says, I was always puzzled by a verse. He quotes the verse, the pasuk, which equates the prophecy of Uriah with the prophecy of Azariah. And Uriah, he said, what Rabbi Kiva didn't understand is that Uriah was a prophet who prophesied in the first times of the first Beis HaMikdash. He lived and prophesied in that time. And Azariah was a prophet in the second Beis HaMikdash, and Uriah was more like a prophet of destruction. Azariah was a prophet of consolation and comfort. And the verse puts the two together as if they lived in the same era, as if they were preaching to the same crowd. Yet they were different crowds. So he wants to know why. So he never understood why. Now he understands, because the prophet Uriah says that there will come a time when the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed and it will be plowed over as a field and foxes will live there. So I see that prophecy is being fulfilled. So what the verse is telling us is that just like that prophecy is being fulfilled, the prophecy of Uriah, so then the prophecy of Azariah, where Azariah says that there will come a time when young people and old people will live in Jerusalem and will hear their voice will be heard throughout the streets of Jerusalem. So just like that took place, so too I know that this one's going to take it. Just as the first prophecy was fulfilled, the prophecy of destruction, Uriah's prophecy, I know the next prophecy is also going to be fulfilled, and so I'm laughing. Alright, very interesting story. And then, so the sages turn to Rabbi Akiva, and this is how the tractate concludes. And they say, you've comforted us, Rabbi Kiva, you've comforted us. Using a double, say, repeating themselves, doubly comforted. All right. Beautiful. So the Maharsha, who's a 16th century commentator on the Gemara, says that, asks an interesting question. He says, what is the fox doing in the story? What do you need that prop for? I could tell you the story without the fox. All you need to say is that Rabbi Akiva was happy and the sages were upset, and Rabbi Akiva said it's because if the prophecies of destruction have been fulfilled to such a high degree, then I know that the prophecy of redemption will be fulfilled to such a high degree. So he absolutely was, what do you need the fox for? What's the fox doing over there? And the Marsha answers that the fox is integral to the comfort, to the consolation, and to the whole story. And a very powerful message, because apparently foxes, at least Israeli foxes, don't like to live, says the Marsha, in built-up places, in civilized places where there's people. Right? Is that not true of dingoes? I mean, dingoes don't really live in the city, right?
There are foxes in Caulfield.
There are foxes in Caulfield. Maybe they're Jewish. There was a rabbi fox here at one stage, classmate of mine. But Israeli foxes are shy creatures. They don't live, so they'll only live in uninhabited areas, in places where there's no people. So what Rabbi Akiva was saying is something very interesting. He was saying that throughout the ages, there have been so many people who've conquered Israel and tried to live there. There have been Muslims, there's been Crusaders, there's been Turks, there's been Romans, there have been Greeks. I mean, on and on and on. The list is endless about how many people captured. I think Jerusalem was captured by 18 different nations. And all of them have the land has the same reaction to all of them. It dries up, it becomes dangerous, disease-ridden, marshy, desert, uninhabitable. So what Rabbi Akiva looked at them and he said, aha, I get it. I was afraid that when after the temple would be destroyed and the Jews would be exiled from Israel, from the land of Israel, I was concerned that somebody else could take it over and the land would invite them in and would respond to them in the same way that it responds to the Jewish people. Now I see a fox. That's my consolation. By seeing the fox, I understand that this land will never react to anybody except the Jewish people. And it's so true because, look, in 1948 we came back and it was that. It was swampy marshlands, it was deserts, nothing grew from there, there was no life, it was a dusty, dangerous, and uninhabitable place. And then when the Jewish people came there, it's as if the place came to life again. Suddenly they were growing the top tulips. I don't know if you know, but the top tulips in the world, they won awards and came from Israel, from the Gaza Strip, actually, when Jews were there. And there's another good example. As soon as Jews unilaterally left the Gaza Strip, it's kind of returned back to its unproductive roots. There's a series of years where there's been crop failures over there, everything. When Jews were there, it was thriving because the land almost pulsates together with the Jewish people. You know, it's interesting, there was once a minister of education in Israel, and her name was Shulamit Aloni. And the March of the Living, which is this program where high school kids go to Poland and then off to Israel. So in Israel, the Israeli kids that participate on the March of the Living, it falls under the Department of Education in Israel. So it's the Department of Education funds and organizes the Israeli contingent that go on the March of the Living. And therefore, the Minister of Education has to go with, it's part of her duties, or his duties, that they would have to attend. So in her year, she went with the people, and they have this incredible have this magnificent ceremony, well, not magnificent, very moving ceremony in Auschwitz. It's presided over many years, or at least the year I was there, and some others, by Rabbi Lau. And they get different people to speak, from politicians to rabbis to Holocaust survivors. And it's a very moving ceremony. I remember when I was there, I took a group of people. Just parenthetically, they were adults. The core of the group were five survivors. And then we were about 45 people in total, all from my shul in Montreal. And there were five survivors. Each survivor had at least a child on the trip, and at least a grandchild, but mostly more than one child and one grandchild. So, and all the five survivors had in common that none of them wanted to go on the trip. We had to really convince them and use our powers of persuasion, and the children, the grandchildren. And they all also, when they returned, it was cathartic for them. I mean, they really returned telling all their friends that you have to go. They were so reluctant to go, but then they came back and they told all their friends that it was the greatest thing to do, because when they got there, it was their revenge against Hitler, that they could come and say, here you go, you wanted to destroy me, here are my grandchildren, right? And in every case, they all had grandchildren there. So it was very moving. I mean, when one of the men, one of the survivors, went and hugged Rabbi Lau, because they were both child survivors at the same time. And as things worked out, they were hugging, you know, they see each other periodically every 3 or 4 years, and this, you know, it's been 3 or 4 years since they'd seen each other. They've kept up a relationship right throughout the world. Elie Wiesel was the third child in their little group, and they were hugging each other and they were crying, as you can imagine. And what we didn't know, but they explained to us afterwards, is that the place where they actually met in Auschwitz was outside the barracks where they were in Auschwitz when they were there. And then afterwards they took us inside and they showed us where they slept in the barracks. And so there were a lot of stories like that. Like, one of the guys just started crying where was it? It must have been Auschwitz. Also, just started crying. And we were like, why are you crying? He said, you see those trees over there? He said, that's the last time I saw my brother alive. They shot him in front of those trees. And it was very moving thing. And then, of course, everyone assembles, and there's this big presentation, and a very important part of the presentation is that they have a prayer service at that time. And Shulamit Aloni is a self-professed atheist. She doesn't believe in God. So at the end of the ceremony, she told a reporter, she said, I don't understand my country. I don't know why they feel the need that they have to pray at every opportunity. So I agree with her. She doesn't understand her country at all. Because, and I'll tell you another story that happened on my March of the Living, in that we went to Majdanek, and Majdanek is a really frightening place because it's so well preserved that they figure it's about 24 hours away from being an active concentration camp. It's very well preserved. And I took my group of 40 odd people into gas chambers. Thank you. My mind's blocked out that word. Went into one of the gas chambers, and I asked our Polish guide if she wouldn't mind closing the door so we could get a sense of what it feels like inside. And, you know, it closed. It's a very dark place. And I was just showing people. I said, you know, it's interesting, the Holocaust survivors, obviously, they were all kind of short. And then their grandchildren, who had, I guess, better nutrition than them, were all quite tall. But I said, you know, try and figure the average height of a person in those days and look at the difference between where your head is and where the roof is. And so they look, and I said, you know, the Germans would try to be very efficient and use as little Cyclone B gas as possible for the maximum effect. And so what they did is they actually would worked it out that you could put children horizontally on top of the heads, between the head and the roof and the ceiling, which was like a concrete roof. So I said that explains that little gap between where your head is and where the roof is. At that point, one of the ladies, not a Holocaust survivor, one of the children of the Holocaust survivor, a lady, suddenly just shouted out at the top of her lungs, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and everyone, all the 45 of us, not the Polish guide, she wasn't Jewish, all screamed back, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, like with such passion and fervor. Now that was a Thursday afternoon. Right after we left Majdanek, the plan was, and that's what we did, we drove to the airport in Krakow, I think the airport was, and then we flew out to Israel, and we landed in Israel on Friday morning. And Poland was kind of like the weather is today, rainy and dreary and cold, and of course we landed in Israel and sunny and bright and warm, and that is an accurate reflection of the roller coaster, the emotional roller coaster that you go through. So we come to Israel, and that Friday night we were at the Kotel. 24 hours later, we're at Majdanek on Thursday night, and Friday night we're at the Kotel. So we're standing at the Kotel with my little group, and you know, there's hundreds of people at the Kotel on Friday night. And I said to them, so I gathered them all together, and I said, we're going to do Ma'ariv now. We're going to pray the evening prayers, and I want you to, when we get to the Shema, I need you to say the Shema with as much fervor and enthusiasm as you can, because I want to erase that Shema that you said. I don't want that to be your greatest Shema. I want this to be your greatest Shema. I want this to be the one you're going to remember. And there were a whole bunch of people around us, and they heard the story, and you know, I kind of embellished it a bit. And then we said the Shema, and everyone was screaming Shema Yisrael, and the rest of the people at the Kotel were looking at us like we're a little bit absurd, but thank God, I think we turned that into our primary Shema Yisrael. And then I told everyone, my blessing is that all your Shema Yisrael should be like the second one. Now, these people weren't religious, but that had a lot of meaning, and that was the highlight of the entire very incredible trip for these people. And when they do study after study, recently there was a study where they asked how many Israelis believe in God, and they consistently get in the high 90% of Israelis will say that they believe in God, that they believe in a heaven, that they believe in, but not necessarily that they're observant or religious, not at all. In fact, I understand that a very high percentage of Israelis, their entire and only Jewish experience in a whole year is the number one Jewish experience for a non-observant Israeli.
Riding a bike on Yom Kippur.
That's a close second. Yom Kippur, the beaches are all full. Not that I know firsthand, I'm just telling you. the number one, and in many cases only, exposure to Judaism that a person has is a Lag BaOmer parade organized by Chabad. Chabad Lag BaOmer parades are the most Jewish thing that Israelis do as a nation. I guess if you take out the religious ones. But so Lag Ba, you know, that's your whole Judaism, and yet you still believe in God. It's a country that I don't believe, with all due respect, Shulamit Aloni has the tools to understand what that is about. But I want to try and get a little bit into that by telling you a story. And I heard the story from a person who knows the people who are involved in the story. So the story takes place in the darkest days of the Second Intifada. And it was a very frightening time, and people were very concerned. So in Israel, Chabad, again, launched a campaign, a very interesting campaign. And they went door to door, and they knocked on doors, and they asked people to accept upon themselves a mitzvah, any good deed. They had a list of suggestions, but it could be any good deed. Leman bitachon haaretz, in order for the security and the safety of the land. And so they asked, went around and encouraged people to accept the mitzvah on themselves. So a couple of guys, they knock on this door of this, they knock on this door in this apartment building, and a young boy, a teenager answers the door, and they ask him, he explains he's alone, his parents aren't there, and they say, okay, well, you could help us. We're going around asking people to accept an extra mitzvah, of the performance of an extra mitzvah upon themselves to make a good resolution, Leman Bitachon Haaretz, for the safety and security of Israel. So this young man didn't consider himself religious at all. This was in Tel Aviv. Didn't consider himself religious. But he liked the idea. It appealed to him that he could do something tangible for the security of Israel. So his resolution was that he would wear a kippah, he would wear a yarmulke on Friday nights. And he would do this specifically. He would put on the yarmulke and he would wear it for Leman Bitachon Haaretz and for Israel's security. So the first Friday night after that encounter with the Chabadnikim, with the advent of Shabbos, the guy duly does what he's told, what he resolved to do. He puts on a kippah, and then he gets ready and he prepares to go out to a disco. So he gets into the car and they're driving off, and at first his buddies, they don't notice that he's wearing a head covering. But sometime during the drive to the disco, one of the occupants of the car notices that his friend's wearing a yarmulke, and he says, "Take it off! What are you wearing? Take it off!" So the young man responds, "No, I'm wearing it for Israel's security." So as these things can occasionally happen in Israel, everyone in the car immediately gets involved in a very heated discussion. It's very loud and boisterous, and they all insist that he remove his head covering. They knew that they would be deeply embarrassed to be seen with a person wearing such an obvious religious symbol. I mean, they argued with him all sorts of arguments. It was Shabbat, and therefore it would be hypocritical if he wore a kippah in a discotheque. They reminded him that he wasn't one of these religious fanatics they pleaded with him to accept an obvious logic that placing a piece of material on his head is not going to have any tangible effect. They threatened him, they begged him, they tried to convince him, but there was no reasoning with this young man. Israel's security was at stake, and he wasn't about to jeopardize Israel's security on account of a little peer pressure, so no way. Now, of course, the friends were too mortified to drive into the discotheque with their buddies sporting such an undeniable religious symbol, so they kept circling around the block, trying to convince him of the error of his ways. And suddenly, as they're driving around, they hear a huge explosion. A loud explosion. Because the discotheque that was their intended destination was a Tel Aviv beachfront venue known as the Delphinarium. That Friday night, a terrorist detonated a bomb that killed 21 people and injured 132 people in that disco that they were going. So the kippah saved the life of its wearer and all the other occupants of the car, because they couldn't reach harm's way because they were too busy arguing over their kippah. And that story, together with this phenomena of the land almost responding to us, tells me that our connection with Israel, the Jewish connection with Israel, is not a connection that any other people has with any geographic location. Look, we're all good citizens, I hope. I'm not a citizen yet, but I hope to be one day, of Australia, right? And we pay our taxes, we abide by the laws of this country, we appreciate the wonderful society that's tolerant and allows people to succeed in every way, to practice their religion. And so we're very happy that we're here in Australia, and we could be very proud. We can have great loyalty to this country, as Jews do in many countries in the world. And many Australians weren't born here, but like myself, they chose to come here, or their ancestors chose to come here, and we're very happy that we're here. But somehow, the connection that a Jew has, even a Jew who's totally unaware of what is happening in Israel, maybe even doesn't know Israel exists, there's a soul connection that binds him to that land that is different than what would bind him to Australia or to the United States or to any other country in the world. And that, the proof that that exists to me is how the land responds when Jewish people come there. The fact that when other nations have tried to conquer and inhabit Israel, that they have not succeeded in cultivating the land, and the land is almost, to use a biblical phrase, spat them out. But when Jewish people have come, the land has responded by coming back to life. And there's no question that a Jew walking around in Australia, because of that soul connection that they have with the land of Israel, even though through most of our history, the vast majority of our history, we've actually not even been allowed to physically enter the geographic location of Israel, that has not stopped us at every single wedding from breaking a glass because Jerusalem is destroyed, or every time we bench after eating bread that we mention Jerusalem, or at the end of every Seder and at the end of Yom Kippur saying L'shana Ba Birushalayim and facing Israel whenever we pray, we have a soul connection with this piece of property that is much deeper, more profound, more and more real than anything that Shulamit Aloni could even imagine in her wildest imaginations. So the title of this talk is the agony and the ecstasy of sovereignty. And I don't think I'm going to actually get into that subject. That's the introduction to the subject. But of course, if we look at the past 63 years, there's been good news and bad news. Of course, the good news is we're back in Israel. We have access to the land, physically, not only spiritually. And of course, the great achievements, accomplishments, technologically and otherwise, of Israel and its citizens is, of course, a marvel that the whole world is just stunned at. And the fact that the country came back to life. But there are problems, of course, as well. So that's the ecstasy, but there's agony as well. There's been a great price that we've had to pay to have that. And it's on one hand been tremendously healing, because over time we have over 2,000 years we've been persecuted, burnt, decapitated, told that we don't belong, and now finally we have a place, a physical place that we can feel that we belong, and we indeed do belong. But then again, that the healing hasn't been complete. We still have a low self-esteem from those 2,000 years. So when somebody comes along, you know, today is the beginning of the month of Tammuz, and in 2 days' time on Shabbat is going to be Gimel Tammuz, which is the Yahrzeit of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it's interesting that when Sadat came to Israel, the Israelis were very excited about that. And so they gave away, they gave him a gift for coming to Israel, and the gift was because he came over as the head of another country, and the gift they gave him was Yamit, a city, the Sinai Desert, and all the oil that Israel had, or most of the oil that they had, as a gift, because we were euphoric that somebody had came, and that's still based on our, you know, low self-esteem. So in 1967, when we had a miraculous victory over many millions and millions of people who were well-funded and had very advanced armies, and we weren't, and we overcame them and we won, and we still were suffering from that Galut mentality where we said, oh, maybe we don't deserve this, maybe we don't deserve, you know. Unfortunately, I deal with, I counsel a few women who are in abusive marriages. And the one thing about an abusive, a victim of spousal abuse is that their self-esteem suffers. The spouse, the abuser, will very often use as a as a weapon against the victim, will often use, say that, oh, you're worthless, you can't do anything without me, you're nothing. And this saps the person from their self-esteem. They really start believing that without the abusive husband, they would never be able to exist on their own, which of course is not true. But they start believing it. And so we are a victim of abuse. 2,000 years of abuse. We've been with an abusive world that has done everything they can to tell us that we're worthless. We start believing it. So having our own country has gone a long way to helping us realize that we are... That we do have a right to exist and to defend ourselves and to have a sovereign nation and to be secure and to educate our children in the way that we want to, and the world, and to practice our religion as we want to. But and that has been very healing, and that's part of the ecstasy. But part of the agony is that as healing as it's been, there's still a long way to go. We still don't really believe that we deserve our land, that we deserve to be there, that we deserve to have that land. Even after winning a war where we were defending ourselves, a defensive war, which we won, we still were right away running to give back as many of the territories that we had gained through great sacrifice after the Six-Day War. All that is to say, there's a lot of good, there's some negative, in my opinion, but ultimately, what we could do for Israel today, living here in Australia, we actually can do a lot for Israel. Because if my central thesis was today that that our connection to Israel is a soul connection, a spiritual connection, and a uniquely spiritual connection, then we have the ability to do spiritual deeds like that kid who put on a yarmulke, and those deeds have a real and tangible effect on Israel. I think that they would have a tangible effect on any country, but because of the nature of our soul connection that we have with Israel, that is even more true. So,
what do you mean by that? We have a soul connection with Israel. I don't get the link.
It was what I was saying before. Yeah. You missed it. I was saying that our connection to Israel... What's that?
Listen to the podcast.
Listen to the podcast, yes. Our relationship with Israel is not a physical one. It's a miraculous one. And it's one that's connected that even though we've never... most Jews throughout history have never been physically on Israel, because through most of our history we have not really had access to Israel. We've still always placed Israel in a central way in every prayer, in every significant Jewish ceremony. It always features over there. So there was always a connection, but it's not a connection like any other nation has a connection to a land. That at a minimum, any other nation has to at least be on the land, at a minimum, to have a connection with it. In our case, it's been the opposite. We have not had a physical connection with it all through these years, and yet we've maintained a spiritual connection. So therefore, we must conclude that it's not an entirely physical connection. And since it is spiritual, we can actually affect it through doing spiritual things, leman bitachon aretz, for the sake of the security of the land of Israel. And those things have a real and tangible benefit on Israel. It's interesting that King David, who was a very successful warrior king, right? I mean, he had very successful armies, he ran successful military campaigns, and he was very careful that every soldier that he had that went out to war, he would have a Torah scholar to stay behind and study Torah. So it was a one-to-one relationship. Every soldier that went out there had a Torah scholar that stayed behind, and that was that soldier's Torah scholar. And the Torah scholar stayed behind to study, and in the merit of that Torah scholar's study, that soldier was successful in battle. So, King David realized, and as did many Jewish leaders, that our relationship to this whole physical world is not a normal empirical relationship. It's a spiritual relationship that exists on a different plane, in a different realm. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
In short, but you can listen to the podcast to get the rest. Any other questions, comments, criticisms, concerns? Great. So don't forget to bench if you ate bread.